Boom. Everybody, welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian Wade, Manisha, coming to you live every day with the number one HR show. So, Brian, Manisha, today, and we'll get to our guests here in a second. So, got a lot of weird energy today. So, we're going to see how that plays out in the next 29 minutes and 1 second. So, everybody, fasten your seatbelts. David Lewis, welcome to Drive Through HR.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So, well, let's kick it off. Have you introduce yourself to our listeners, and then we'll jump into what's kind of top of mind at the at the moment.
Sure. Well, my name is David Lewis. I am President and CEO of Operations Inc. We are a 12-year-old human resources outsourcing and consulting firm based in Norwalk, Connecticut. 40 employees supporting a little over 700 clients, most of whom do not have their own in-house human resources department because they're not large enough for the most part to do so. So they use our team as their HR organization. We're also owners of AllCountyJobs.com, which is a network of 21 job boards running from Washington, D.C. to Massachusetts. Think Monster or Career Builder, but on a regional level, and we focus on jobs within counties within those states.
Got it. Well, damn, 12 years old, that's like in dog years, that's huge for both a consulting firm and just as an entity.
It's been a great run. It's an interesting niche to be in. It's typically a niche that unemployed HR professionals fall in and then out of. And I think that's been one of the secrets is by sticking with it and continuing to do the things I used to do in larger companies, but doing it for smaller businesses, we've managed to create a really nice reputation for ourselves and a great base of clients supported by a great group of people.
Well, that is, that's fantastic because obviously you've been through a couple cycles relative to kind of the HR landscape. And so I think it's really valuable to kind of, I guess my first question is, what's the difference between now and when you started the company from an HR kind of like very kind of the horizon of kind of human capital?
Well, these last 5 years are like no other 5 years I think anybody alive has really witnessed, unless you're in your 80s or 90s and can remember the Great Depression. and even then, I mean, I think the dynamics that exist now, if you think about it, we're still recovering from 2008. We have a workforce that has been forced to be more productive and take less money for it, something I don't think anybody ever would think would exist. You've got a bunch of people who started out unemployed in 2008 and now feel unemployable in 2013. So there's a lot of differences today from what existed when I first started, which was really a few months before 9/11. And the country itself was in shock, but for a different reason. I think the country's been in shock from an economics perspective, and it's made some lasting changes that I don't see going away anytime in the near term.
Well, and that's, and I think what what's interesting is, and I'd love to get, I can't wait to hear your take on this. So say that you have been, you've probably heard the term on-ramping. Where you have people, you have professionals who have been out of the workforce for, say, 5 years for whatever reason, family, economic situation, going back to school, and now we're trying to enter back into the job market. What do you think the overall appetite is for that from small company to large company?
You know, I think those people right now are and have for the last several years found it more and more difficult to find an opportunity to walk in the door. And in the job hunting world these days, it's all about finding the side door, the back door, the trap door, and doing everything you can to avoid the front door, because the front door tends to be looking for perfection, and most people don't meet that perfection for one reason or another. So the folks you're talking about in returning to the workforce, per se, are people that are going to probably find those opportunities regardless of the size of organization through someone they know, through someone they used to work with. They're going to have to find some pretty strong common bonds. And in the sort of the LinkedIn generation of job seekers, it's not that difficult to do it, but I just see so many people who really don't understand how to go about doing that.
Yeah, completely. I mean, completely agree with that. So kind of staying on that same theme, sort of, how do you define the new generation workforce? Because this is something that, you know, it comes up in lots of different flavors and kind of styles, but at the end of the day, I'd love to hear, because you have a lot of clients, you've been through a lot of cycles, what's your definition of it? And second part of that question is, how do people need to start thinking about it?
Well, I think that the new generation workforce is split up in a bunch of different categories. You have those people that came out of college within the last few years who in many cases aren't in the workforce yet, or if they are, they're underemployed or they're engaged in positions that never were part of their master plan. They went to college, they got a good degree, they found no opportunities out there, and they're painting houses or flipping burgers because they need to make a living because they don't want to live anymore with mom and dad. The people who came out a little bit earlier than them and maybe came out of some of the better schools, you know, they're going into an environment where compensation is not as robust, where upside potential is not as robust, and where the demands on them are greater. But, I think those people who are in that category are so much better positioned to be sort of the great generation, if you will, of workers 10, 20 years from now, because they're coming into an environment where productivity is so much higher and where expectations are so much lower. And when you go into a situation like that and that's where you cut your teeth, you're going to get hopefully back into a better economy where you're still going to work at that level. You're going to get rewarded better. It's going to motivate you that much more. And I think most of those people are going to be the stars. Then you got this whole other second group of people who gave up on the path they were on, took four or five steps backwards just so they could get back into the workforce. And now they're sort of super contributors at a much lower level, still hoping to get back to the level they used to be at. And that group of people as well, if you found someone in your environment, in your workplace, those people are huge assets. So I think those two generations of people in today's workforce are real positive influencers in where things are headed in the future.
Do you think the kind of the step back and the broadening of skill sets and kind of purview and how you can contribute to the organization is making kind of the workforce too much into generalists versus kind of specialists?
It's a good question. I think the numbers you read out there and all of the political banter suggests that, you know, most of us work in small businesses. So, you know, if you take that at face value and you say, you know, that three-quarters of the workforce are in smaller businesses, then being a generalist is a huge asset. The narrower your focus, the more one-dimensional you are, the less valuable you're going to be to to the potential employer in that space. And it's interesting when you see people coming out of the small business ranks and going or leaping into bigger companies, they actually tend to be leaping into more senior roles because those senior roles tend to be more diversified and more generalist oriented. So I'm not a big fan of the specialist track. And if you really want to look at why, look at all of the specialists that were in the workforce in 2008 that were on the sidelines watching in 2009, because those people were looked at by the management teams of those organizations that had a downsize and saying, hey, you know what? We need someone who can handle three or four different positions. And some of those specialists, if not most of them, just weren't capable or seen as capable of taking those other things on, mostly because they probably had never been given a chance to do those things. So I vote for the generalist track. I think that's the better track to be on.
Well, that's interesting.
Go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, I'm adding to that particular thought, as you said, generalist and specialist. I want to tie that thought to the succession planning strategy of an organization. Let's just say we have leaders in the organization who are sort of, generalist and have all the areas that they know about the business. But when we take that middle-level management but when we take them to a succession planning processes and thinking of promoting them or to have a new role, do you think that's going to be a challenge for the organization?
I go back to, the first corporate job I had was in 1992 for a very large company who serviced the pharmaceutical industry. And I remember a guy I worked with, and the reason I remember him was because I sat with my boss one day in one of those organizational development meetings, and the company was growing rapidly, and the leadership from the different departments and divisions were there. And everybody wanted this guy. Everybody was vying for him to become part of their organization. And when you took a look at who he was and what he did, he wasn't being vetted or pursued because of his specific experiences. He was being vetted or pursued because of his core skills. And, that goes back to the concept of going out and interviewing for a job on an exploratory basis versus being interviewed for a job that's already been defined. If you can find opportunities where people build around what you're good at doing, you're going to be far better off overall than if you're taking jobs that have already been defined for you and you're trying to see if you're the square peg that fits the square hole. So from a succession planning perspective, for the larger organizations, yes, you're going to need people who have strengths and very specific and concentrated strengths in certain areas. But I think if you can find people that are talented and have good core skills, you usually can adapt them to the roles that you have planned for them in the future.
Well, definitely appreciate kind of giving some framework around thinking about that, because definitely what I've seen, especially when you get back into growth mode and you start getting into kind of scarcity of talent, it seems like all hell breaks loose and all plans for succession and bench strengthening, it just goes, you'll go back into a reactionary mode. And it sounds like that you feel, and I agree with this, if you have more utility players who have a lot of skills versus like being like supercharged or super former in their lane, you got a better shot to kind of ride out and figure out your strategy.
Well, I think that's true. I think if you ask the small businesses that are stronger today than they were prior to the end of 2008, they will tell you that it's attributed in part, if not significantly, to people like that with that type of broad skills. I like to call them jack of all trades, master of many versus master of none, because those people I'm thinking about could be dedicated, committed resources to any one specific niche, at least in terms of their skill set. The interesting thing about a lot of those people I'm thinking about is that they'd probably be miserable in a job that only allows them to do one of the four or five things that they maybe presently own in today's employment.
Great. I'm going to do a quick reset, everybody. You're listening to Brian and Nishav with our wonderful guest, David Lewis. David, I want to get your take on, you are dealing with a lot of employees in various organizations, as you said, 700 or so. So basically, from an outsourcing perspective, a lot of employers have this question in their mind, and they are still thinking about it. What areas of HR can be outsourced?
Well, I think it depends on the size of the company. We run a business where we don't take every client that comes to us thinking that we're what they need. I'd rather be more true to, you know, the perspective that the business owner would have, or that more specifically, if they were hiring me as a consultant for a second versus saying we need to outsource, you know, I get them to take a step back and say, okay, well, let's see, what do you have? So I'll give you a perfect example. We had a prospect that came to us who said they want to outsource their HR function. And in the process of assessing their situation, they have 550 employees and no human resources department. They have a specific brand. They have a specific culture. And my comment back to the CFO I was talking to was, you're much more in need of our services in this fashion. Have us go ahead and assess and fix anything that's missing in terms of your HR infrastructure. And then let us help you hire somebody to do most of the work that's involved in HR. So to go back to your question, I think a lot of companies, you know, if there's a consistent heartbeat to the function and it adds up to a regularly scheduled or group of hours per week, it probably is worthwhile to bring in-house, provided you can find the talent. If there's an inconsistency to it or a high level of specialty to it, then maybe that's the opportunity to outsource. And the inconsistency piece may be that it's a 5 or 8 hour kind of a function, and you've been doing it in-house up until this point. Things like HR administration or onboarding, definitely things like compliance. You know, going ahead and asking for an expert to do that is so much different than having someone who's mostly an administrator or someone in finance do it intuitively, because intuitively to them has got the wrong intuition. They look at it as an administrative function, not as a skill function. Then, a business that's going to hire 3 or 4 people a year, you know, a lot of us outsource recruiting, but, you know, there's cheaper ways to outsource recruiting than headhunting. You can go to firms like ours and have us do the recruiting for you for a fraction of the cost of what you spend on a headhunter. There's things like payroll processing, where a lot of companies think in terms of outsourcing payroll processing to large players like ADP and Paychex. That's great, but what about the actual function of compiling all that info? It's a real difficult nuisance type of a job that requires someone to take 4 or 5 hours a week, time out from everything else, and focus on. That's a good piece of the puzzle to outsource. And then as businesses grow, getting some strategic input, looking at HR differently from what is, for a small business, a necessary evil when thinking of human resources, to now a strategic piece of the puzzle for their future planning.
So, David, what's probably the biggest skill gap area if you look across, like, all of functional HR, you know, the HR functions? Where's probably the piece that you see missing from a talent perspective within the companies you deal with and just from your experience?
The key area, without question, that wins the race by 1,000 yards is salespeople. It is amazing how our clients, regardless of the nature of the business they're in, are having an incredibly difficult time finding sales talent. Part of it's because These are organizations that don't have an internal function to train salespeople, so they don't have the benefit of taking essentially a raw piece of clay in the form of a recent college grad and mold them into a successful salesperson. So they're looking for experience. And experienced salespeople unfortunately fall into two categories, to be very blunt about it. If they're looking for work, most of the time it's indicative of how good a job they do at sales. And if they're not looking for work, it's because they're successful in the organization they're in, which means you're going to have to pluck them by paying them a lot more money and convincing them that what they have to sell for you is that much more lucrative for them in the long run. It's still going to take a learning curve. So it's amazing, but the sales skill seems to be the most absent by far, at least in the markets that we service.
No, I would agree with that 100%. And it's, and that actually, by the way, was a Twitter's, I came off the Twitter's stream. So, it's interesting because, and for everybody that wants to, play in the minors on that, there are outliers, of course, that have transitioned for whatever reason. But if you look at the overall, the overall curve, how you described it is exactly right. And so your only option is really take people that haven't did a lot in sales and put them into a, some kind of sales role and try and develop them into understanding product, understanding, kind of pipelining sales process and closing deals, right? So that's really your only other option.
Yeah, it goes back to the idea of hiring for core skills versus hiring for what it says on the person's resume. I'm a big believer in personality profiling as well, and that says a lot, having been a huge skeptic the first time I was ever introduced to this. So I just couldn't figure out for the life of me how a test that took 15 minutes and asked me what seemingly a bunch of random questions could somehow peg me for who I am, how I like to work, and where I'll succeed versus where I'll fail. But when you do testing like that of known quantities of longstanding employees, you're blown away by how accurate these things are. Because you know what the tests should say, and when the tests say that and peg that person, you become a convert. And I think in the sales area in particular, there's some great ways to be able to test salespeople or prospective salespeople, forgetting what it says on their resume, but what you feel in that interview could be a good fit because they're personable, they communicate well, et cetera, of having that test to be able to validate that the person you're looking at is, in fact, someone who at least has the right makeup to potentially succeed in a sales role. And then you got to give them the training.
Yeah, in my experience, I mean, being from, and I like the assessment plug, by the way, being in the assessment world for the last 13 years, and definitely a huge, huge kind of evangelist of science to help you, predictive science to help you, have elements of data points to make decisions in your hiring development, all those things, coaching, you name it. But salespeople, by far, overall, are the most difficult to actually hire for because they're in a position. I mean, their personality has been wrapped around, and we're talking about the majority of the sample or the curve, is literally they've been wrapped around making and presenting a product or a service and themselves in the best light possible. So it's just a little bit different,
Yeah, and I think, certainly with the salespeople that are out there, it's always a question also of how quickly you can assess whether they're going to succeed or fail, how much time you have based on how much you can afford. I mean, listen, first job for me was as a headhunter, and the organization that hired me had 120 people on staff as one of the largest employment agencies in New York City. I was one of six people in that room on the first day. And clearly, as I learned in the years to follow, the strategy for that business was to hire the six of us and hope one of us succeeded. And if one of us succeeded, great, because we would pay essentially for the cost of the other five failing, plus hopefully we'd be there for the long term. And, you know, in that class of six, two of us actually succeeded. But I love the idea, provided you have the means to do so, to accept the notion that it's probably better to bring a group of people in. They tend to work better together in that kind of environment. It creates for the right people a level of competition, which is great for a sales environment. And, you know, no one ever complains when four of those people are successful. The big complaints come when you put all your eggs in one basket and hire one person and they don't succeed, and now you're back to square one.
Well, this is an interesting topic because, as we all know, sales is actually an art. You have to pitch your ideas, you have to promote your ideas and present it to the customers, and then convince them to buy, which is like influencing them. So I have a question to both of you, both Brian and David. So if you are an interviewer and you have a candidate, by looking at their traits, how would you suggest that candidate is suitable for sales or marketing? Because both of the skills, like marketing and sales, are equally required. So how do you judge a candidate is suitable for sales or marketing?
From my end, I'm looking at what I see in front of me in the course of that conversation, because to me, that's a sales call. That interview is their first sales call for me. So that's as much of an audition as anything else. As far as their background is concerned, you know, again, I'm looking for common themes and threads. Are they, you know, do they have responsibility for making presentations? Do they have responsibility for doing any type of convincing of individuals internally or externally? Do they have a service mentality? I want to see in the interview if they're a good listener, but, you know, I also want to ask those behavioral type interviewing questions that help me get to that core. And as long as I've been interviewing, I've been doing this 27 years, I don't trust my gut completely. I trust it strongly, but, you know, I as I said to Brian and Brian reaffirmed before, I think, you know, you're looking for other points of validation. It's why you have other people in your organization interview candidates versus them just seeing one person. It's also, as a side, why when you do that, you don't tell them what you thought of the candidate in any specific terms. Don't taint their opinion. Let them come out with their own opinion after the interview. And then you do the kind of behavioral testing that helps validate or invalidate what it is that you've seen in front of you.
Yeah, and I would when it comes down, I mean, you definitely have to have the objective components, and you have to have multiple people involved, and you have to do situational interviewing. I mean, you really have to tee it up, because is it a consultative sell? Is it a more tactical sell? Is it a long sales cycle? Is it something that's going to be a lot of change? So within the personality, like, for example, the behavioral testing, if they have to adapt to a lot of, like, fluid change, like in product sets or service sets or potentially industry sets, those are things that you can actually extract or glean from the information out of the assessments, you know, as a data point. That's very objective, right? Because assessments never have bad days. That's the one thing that always has stuck with me from day one when somebody told me that, is the assessments never have bad days, right? So the halo effect is really non-existent, you know, relatively speaking. So, well, David, we've got about 60 seconds left. So where can folks connect with you? And thank you for being on the show. It was a quick and enjoyable 30 minutes.
Well, my pleasure, and thanks for having me. Folks can find my human resources firm at operationsinc.com. And if you're out there and want to learn a little bit more about the job market in the Northeast, you can go to allcountyjobs.com. We've also just launched thejobscholar.com, which is a great portal for job seekers for advice and news and information that hopefully will take them from unhappy and newly employed or unemployed to the ranks of the employed.
Well, that's perfect. Everybody connect up with David Lewis. I can't talk. And we are out of here. We'll talk to you tomorrow.